Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the first segment, we discuss the ongoing crisis in Syria. We're joined by journalist Eva Bartlett, who recently returned from Aleppo and the region. We'll discuss many perspectives that challenge the Western NATO and corporate media dominant narrative about what's going on in Syria. In the second segment, we're joined by Joey Johnson from the famous Supreme Court case, 1989, Texas v. Johnson, which upheld the right of Americans to burn the flag as protected free speech and free expression. Johnson is back up on charges for burning the flag in the United States in Cleveland, Ohio, this past summer. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On the beginning of the program today for the first segment, we're going to be talking about the situation in Syria. And we are joined today by a journalist that has been to Syria recently. And here is my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce Eva Bartlett to you, Peter.
Eva Bartlett is a Canadian freelance writer, co-founder of Syria Solidarity Movement, and also a freelance writer who's published in Russia Today, Global Research, Dissident Voice, and a number of other places. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us about your journey in the United States right now and what your main message has been.
I just came back from my sixth visit to Syria, and I've had the chance to travel extensively in the country, largely independently, sometimes with a translator, and speak with Syrians of all backgrounds, faiths, to visit Aleppo four times and to get a sense of the reality on the ground in Aleppo. And I'm trying to share with people here what Syrians have been experiencing under this foreign war on Syria, what they overwhelmingly have said to me and to colleagues, what they want, how they see the resolution of this war on Syria, and just some of the experiences I've had when I've traveled through the country. I'd just like to note one thing. The Syria Solidarity Movement, it is .org on the internet because there is a UK group that has impostered and used the same name to put forth the NATO propaganda.
We know that kind of story, don't we?
Yeah, we certainly do. So, well, Eva Bartlett, you were in Syria then not very long ago. So tell our listeners what it is that you were witnessing and maybe even couch it in some of the other views or contrary positions that you hear.
I'll start with some of the other perspectives and views which are put forth by the corporate media and by some so-called alternative media and also human rights groups. The overriding views that they've put forth, that when they speak of Aleppo, they had been largely speaking of the areas that were occupied by militant or terrorist, as they're called in Syria, factions. They've been speaking of those areas exclusively and not speaking of greater Aleppo, which comprised at least 1.5 million people. In fact, those 1.5 million people were disappeared in most corporate media reports. Along with the disappearance of those 1.5 million people was the suffering they've endured for years at the hands of these foreign-backed terrorists. So the views put forth by these corporate media is that there are 250,000, according to the United Nations, starving civilians in eastern Aleppo, that the Syrians and the Russians are mercilessly bombing them, and that these are revolutionaries that are bringing democracy, freedom, striving for political change in Syria. The reality is that while there is a will for political change within Syria, the mercenaries that the corporate media likes to call rebels and moderates, many of them are foreigners. They are paid. They have been recycled from other conflicts like Libya. And the Syrians that I've met in Aleppo and that colleagues have met and that anybody who's following actual independent or investigative media have heard the voices of these Syrians, they reject this foreign intervention. They reject the sectarianism that they bring with them. And they said, we want the people outside to understand Aleppo is not divided. We are united. And we want the people outside to understand that on a daily basis, we've been suffering from the various bombs that these terrorists have been firing on us. So they've been firing. And I did experience this on many occasions in visits to Aleppo, the firing of gas canister and water heater bombs, which are improvised bombs, extremely deadly in the sense that they may not destroy an entire building, but they can, one single bomb can kill 5 to 10 people at once. And these have been raining down every day on the people of Aleppo, largely to the silence of the corporate media. When I was there, the head of forensics, Dr. Zahar Hajo, made the point that in Aleppo City alone, over the last 4 or 5 years, 11,000 civilians have been killed by these bombs. This is something we won't hear when the UN condemns atrocities that they never have actual sources for. And the United Nations, I made the point that they've been saying for years 250,000 civilians in eastern Aleppo. Well, now, if anybody is following the news coming out of Syria, most of Aleppo has been secured by the Syrian army and its allies, Russia, Hezbollah, etc. And with the securing of these areas that were occupied for years by different militant factions, we've seen that at most maybe 100,000 people have come out of there. And I'm not sure the exact number of militants that have come out, either laid down their weapons. Last time I checked, it was 1,200 Syrians who had taken the government amnesty and laid down their weapons, and other militants who are being bussed out of the remaining holes that they were occupying. But nowhere near the numbers of 250,000 that the UN was purporting for years. And I think it's notable that the United Nations, throughout this war on Syria, has used inflated numbers to pull on the heartstrings of people who are outside of Syria, who are outside of the conflict, who are maybe not as well informed. And along with using these inflated numbers, many of these media and human rights groups have called for foreign intervention in the form of a no-fly zone on Syria. They've even gone so far as to call it a safe zone, implying that the bombing of Syria's infrastructure and their defenses and their ability to defend themselves against these foreign terrorists and against the U.S.-led coalition, which itself has repeatedly bombed villages and civilians and infrastructure, as if this no-fly zone is actually going to bring stability and peace to the people of Syria.
The no-fly zone was used in Libya and really helped bring down the government there. And in the case of Syria, to what extent does the Russian involvement prevent a no-fly zone from being created?
The Russians got involved in Syria physically at the request of the Syrian government. The American, Canadian, et cetera, allied involvement in Syria is illegal, and they were not invited into Syria's airspace. And I can't paraphrase exactly what Russia has said, but I believe that if there was an attempt to impose a no-fly zone, Russia would firmly oppose that, and it could lead to war between the U.S. coalition and Russia.
That's certainly one of the dangerous sides of Syria for the United States, is U.S. involvement there and actual conflict with Russian airplanes and or troops on the ground. So that's certainly a serious concern that many people have had and had had during the election. Often Assad is called a dictator. Can you talk about that a little bit?
People don't take into context the decades preceding 2011 and the many CIA attempted coup d'etats and the Israeli involvement in Syria and the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan. And there's no history or context given to how Hafez al-Assad came to power, the pros and cons of him being in power, and how President Assad, the current President Assad, came into power. And specifically, there is no legitimacy given to the elections of 2014, in which the Syrian people overwhelmingly did choose President Assad. Most corporate media I've seen and allied commentators dispute these elections, although they were recognized by the UN as legitimate. And the Syrian people did overwhelmingly choose President Assad. Just on a personal note, in my own experience conversing with Syrians, including opposition members in Syria, unarmed internal opposition members, who might have been anti-President Assad at the start, they are rallied behind him for various reasons. Some see that he is not the problem, period. Others see he is the solution and the solution for unity, and after there is peace in Syria, to continue with this political process.
Eva Bartlett, in the recent Project Censored book, Censored 2017, we actually have a top 10 story on Syria that Manar Mahawash did at Mint Press News. Manar has also come under criticism for the reporting that she has done on Syria. And it seems like it's a very binary issue, meaning the way in which media tend to cover it, whether it's corporate media or so-called independent media, that if you have any kind of nuanced view or a complex view, that you somehow get shuffled into a certain camp or another as pro-Assad or pro-Putin or these anti-human rights. You're familiar, of course, with a lot of the labels and
yes,
many of them have been hurled at both yourself and at Manar. Since you brought up the history a moment ago, and Gore Vidal once quipped that we live in the United States of amnesia, and you brought up the history of what's been going on in Syria and Western involvement and CIA activities and so forth. Manar brought up another issue, and I just was curious as to your take on this. She was talking about how the war in Syria was spurred by contest for gas delivery to Europe, and it wasn't as much about Muslim sectarianism. Do you have any views on what role that might be playing? This was before 2011.
There are competing pipelines. There's the Qatar-Turkey pipeline that would not be beneficial to Syria, and there's the Syria pipeline with the alliance of Russia and other allies that would be beneficial to Syria. There's a constant U.S. desire to control resources in the Middle East and choke off competitors. And as far as sectarianism, the way the media has portrayed on every level reporting on Syria has been sectarian. They've said it's about Sunnis versus Alawi, but they negate the fact that Aleppo, one of the key cities, is predominantly Sunni. And the people of Aleppo rejected this phony revolution. And the people of Aleppo, who are predominantly Sunni, have been suffering from the terrorism brought in from outside of Syria. And the people of Syria overall reject sectarianism, and they don't identify themselves by their faith. And they actually have coexisted and intermarried and et cetera for years and years. Another point is that in terms of reporting, there are places that are simply not reported on. The media likes to talk about starvation, and in coordinated efforts, they talk about certain areas. Again, not giving all the context, for example, Madaya. Earlier this year, Madaya was a place that everybody was talking about. The media did not focus on the terrorists within and the fact that the terrorists within were hoarding food and preventing people from leaving, just as we've seen with Aleppo. And at the same time as Madaya was being talked about, the media was ignoring Fu and Kafraya, which are two villages which are not Sunni, which are being besieged since March 2015 and attacked on a daily basis by the terrorists that the West calls moderates. And if these villages got any notice, or if other areas that have been terrorized, like Al-Zahra in Homs, got any notice, they were always depicted as an Alawi village, a Shia enclave. And so the media itself made them sectarian, even though these villages themselves were not strictly one particular faith, and they had a history of intermingling with their neighbors that were Sunni, that were Christian, that were Alawi. So this whole thing has been made out to be Sunnis versus an Alawi government. And in fact, the people that are saying these types of things are ignoring the fact that the Syrian government has many top Sunnis in top positions. The Syrian army comprises overwhelmingly Sunnis, and that basically all faiths in Syria are defending their land against this foreign war on their country.
Certainly, the corporate media in the United States and around the world has been anti-Assad for a very long time. That's partly the State Department doing press releases that the media will just run without any questions. So the word propaganda comes up. Talk about what propaganda means in the context of Syria. What are the origins of this one-sided story in the corporate media? And at some point, hit on the White Helmets.
White Helmets is one of the prime examples of propaganda, because they are portrayed as neutral defenders of Syria, as rescuers. They are glorified as being these noble defenders who are under the airstrikes, according to this narrative of the Syrians and the Russians. They are portrayed as neutral. And in fact, you know, they were funded by a British ex-military officer. And my colleagues, Rick Sterling, Vanessa Beely, and many other journalists of integrity have researched deeply into the White Helmets and their origins, and have found that they are not the people they claim to be. And in fact, they are also not neutral. They work exclusively in areas occupied by Al-Qaeda in Syria, Al-Nusra. And much of their footage is quite dubious, and they can be seen to be holding weapons. In one video, they can actually be seen standing on the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. So that in itself makes them not neutral. Another interesting element is that they claim to be supporting the people, say, of Eastern Aleppo. Well, so now Eastern Aleppo has been largely liberated, except for a very small pocket. And almost nobody in Eastern Aleppo has been saved by these White Helmets that have claimed over the years to have been liberating them. In fact, the propaganda around them went to such an extent that not only were they up for the nomination of the Nobel Peace Prize, but you have various funding campaigns like Avaaz or GoFundMe, various platforms actually fundraising for this group that already has, at least by conservative estimates, $100 million of funding from the US, UK, EU nations, and other nations around the world. At the same time, the groups that are not propagandizing are the actual Syrian defenders who are working on the ground, that do not accept foreign bribes and who are actually saving Syrians. For example, the Syrian civil defense throughout Syria, the Syrian Red Crescent, and the defenders of Syria. There are other elements of propaganda. I touched on Madaya and these accusations of starvation campaigns, which again, once people actually look into them, they find that the reason that anybody was starving in Madaya, in Yarmouk, in Aleppo, is not due to the government, but it's due to the presence of terrorists within who have hoarded the food. And you can find now videos coming out of areas of Eastern Aleppo that were occupied showing stockpiles of food and medicine, while these militants claimed that there was no food. And you find, for example, while a 7-year-old girl who purported to be in Eastern Aleppo and was tweeting an amazing amount of tweets every day. Her name was Banal Abid. She was apparently a 7-year-old kid and was tweeting in very articulate and a very extensive vocabulary of English, was tweeting about toppling the regime, about no-fly zones, about genocides. And we're expected, this is one of the major propaganda, we're expected to believe that this kid is capable of tweeting these things and that these tweets are coming from this kid. And in fact, the support for her, I mean, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter writer, supports her. The support for this child is adding to her credibility. People believe that this kid is tweeting. So the level of propaganda has been intense. Anybody who disputes the narrative of NATO, of the United Nations, of Human Rights Watch, of Amnesty International, of Democracy Now!, anybody who disputes these narratives is immediately, this is another element of propaganda, called an Assad agent, a Kremlin agent. And I myself have been called that. We were called paid agents of these two governments. And the fact that we're reporting on the ground and actually reporting the voices with documentation, with photos, with videos, means nothing, because the counter propaganda is to label anybody who dissents as an agent.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On this part of the program today, we're talking about Syria, and we are joined by journalist Eva Bartlett, who has recently returned from Syria, and we were talking about propaganda, counter-propaganda, talking about a lot of material that's been out in the West press, and one of the things, of course, that came up was, Eva Bartlett, you mentioned this child that is purportedly making these sophisticated tweets and so forth and has been championed by many countries and celebrities and so forth. Certainly a tug on the heartstring kind of narrative or story, not potentially unlike what we saw with the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter on the run-up to the first Iraq war, yeah, who was coached by Hill and Knowlton, the PR firm. But going back to this story, because of your UN appearance and because of some of the things that you have done recently to specifically challenge the corporate and NATO propagandistic narrative, you have been attacked. You've been attacked personally. And even Snopes, the website that allegedly debunks things and checks them for truthiness. Do you want to comment on that?
Snopes is not the only one. I was contacted by a journalist from Toronto for BuzzFeed. I haven't had a chance to address the Snopes article because I am on the road and I only briefly scanned it, but I'm aware that both questioned my funding, both made assumptions or allegations, or at least the BuzzFeed, about my funding, claiming that I've been funded by either government. And for the record, I've been self-funded, and when possible, when I've needed money, I've fundraised. And that's not an easy thing to do, to fundraise. It's actually quite humbling. Regarding the UN appearance, there was another allegation that this was organized by what they said, the Syrian so-called regime. In fact, no, I contacted the Syrian permanent representative to the UN after I'd seen that the US Peace Council had done a report back after they had been to Syria. And I said, I have been to Syria a number of times. I'd like to report what I've seen. So I initiated that, not the Syrian government. And in fact, then it was further organized by the Hands Off Syria Coalition. So for the record, that was not a Syrian government initiative. And then this whole thing of calling someone a conspiracy theorist when we dare to venture off the corporate narrative is simply a way of trying to discredit what we have to say. I would implore people to take a look at my writings, at my writings from on the ground, and make your own decision, but not to simply believe what Snopes or BuzzFeed has said. But in fact, although I mentioned that I didn't have a chance to read in detail the Snopes, I believe one of the points they were making, because in the UN conference I did address the fact that one of these main propaganda tools has been to say the Syrian government has destroyed hospitals. And one of the hospital allegations was one called the Quds Hospital. And the point that I made in the press conference, and I can provide a lot of detailed articles and links, one of the points I made was that at the beginning of this year, in another coordinated campaign, all of the corporate media were talking about this Quds Hospital that was allegedly completely destroyed by airstrikes. And some of the media actually then said, well, no, they were destroyed by barrel bombs, because you have to throw the barrel bomb rhetoric in as well. And the point that I made was there is Russian satellite imagery showing that in January, when these allegations were being made, the hospital was in the same physical state as it was in October 2015, months prior. So therefore, it was not, as they were saying, completely destroyed. Snopes, basically, I think what they did was say, I deny that hospitals have been hit, or I deny that Quds was attacked. I made the point that their allegations that it was completely destroyed were not true, and I provided evidence for that. So instead of looking closely at that, they simply just say, I'm a conspiracy theorist.
That's one way to try to shut you up. And you are still out there, independent reporter, from your eyewitness accounts and your presence there, You remind me a whole lot of Dar Jamil when he was active in Iraq. And we have a long history at Project Censored of watching these processes happen. So when you say they use the idea of humanitarian intervention in Syria, that's not the first time they've done that. They certainly did that with Libya. They've done it with Iraq. They did it in Somalia. And oftentimes it's even the same people. The ambassador to Libya was the same person who is now the ambassador to Syria. And he, before that, was working in Iraq. So not only is it the same patterns that we see, and I would certainly add Yugoslavia into this pattern where we had to intervene for humanitarian purposes. And a lot of liberals accept that. They sort of say, oh, yeah, we're saving people's lives, when in fact we accelerate the conflict, feed one side and weaponize one side even more, and then lie about it and demonize reporters like yourself who are trying to tell the truth.
With regard to Robert Ford, one of the early massacres in Syria was in Jisr al-Shughur in Idlib province. That massacre occurred in June or July of 2011, at the time when corporate media were maintaining that there were nonviolent protesters and nobody was armed. I later learned that Robert Ford was in Syria at that time and that he appeared the day after there was a press meeting about that massacre. And the person I was talking with said he saw Robert Ford at that press meeting and he was very red-faced. And he asked him at another meeting, he challenged Ford, why were you red-faced? Were you upset at the fact that your so-called moderates had committed this massacre? Were you upset at the fact that it was actually discovered? He didn't get an answer. But, you know, Robert Ford has been instrumental in the war on Syria. He's never talked about in the corporate media, nor are any of the sponsors of terrorism, although it is documented in U.S. declassified documents that the U.S. has been funding these terrorists and that these massacres have occurred. But again, with the propagandizing, it's always just about Russia and Syria and these manufactured massacres.
Let's go back to this issue of media and this Western narrative. One of the people that has exhibited a bit more clarity and sanity on this that has written in corporate media is Stephen Kinzer, writing months and months ago about how a lot of this stuff that's going on here in this one segment, he talks about militants true to form are wrecking havoc as they are pushed out of the city by Russian and Syrian armed forces. Quote, Turkish-Saudi-backed, quote, moderate rebels showered the residential neighborhoods of Aleppo with unguided rockets and gas jars. And this is one Aleppo resident wrote this in social media. The Beirut-based analyst Marwa Osma asked, the Syrian Arab army, which is led by President Bashar Assad, is the only force on the ground along with their allies who are fighting ISIS. So do you want to weaken the only system that is fighting ISIS? I bring this up simply because Kinzer is bringing this up and saying, well, that kind of information doesn't fit Washington's narrative. It doesn't fit that overall narrative. Right. And Kinzer is a pretty respected academic, the Watson Institute. I know certainly Stephen Cohen and others have chimed in on some of this. But, you know, again, even the coverage on the so-called progressive press or progressive media shows, they've not been so accurate or so good or at least broad or complex, even as we see Kinzer here in the Boston Globe. Your remarks on that and your experience.
I was very pleasantly surprised. I've seen a couple of Kinzer's articles, and I found him to be incredibly fair and well-researched.
Since you bring this up, it says, the Syrian war will be remembered as one of the most shameful episodes in the history of the American press in an article titled, The Media Are Misleading the Public on Syria.
Yeah, and that was absolutely well-written, well-researched, and it's essentially what all of us so-called conspiracy theorists and people who have been on the ground have been saying. So I thoroughly appreciated his analysis. And in terms of him quoting Marwa, who's a colleague based in Beirut, saying the Syrian allies, Hezbollah, etc., are the ones fighting ISIS, that's absolutely true. And this whole concept, this notion that the U.S. coalition are fighting ISIS in Syria is absolutely untrue. The U.S. on many occasions have attacked positions enabling ISIS to take over. I think most notably, we'll remember Palmyra, in which the U.S. alliance somehow missed long convoys of ISIS trucks and SUVs traversing the open desert for hundreds of miles to take over Palmyra, not just from one direction, but from many directions. And then a more recent example was the premeditated U.S. coalition attack on Syrian positions in eastern Deir ez-Zor on September 17th, in an attack that was not just a brief attack, but nearly 1 hour. Multiple attacks, including attacking Syrian soldiers who were retreating, killing at least 83 soldiers and immediately after enabling ISIS to take over that position. And bear in mind that in Deir ez-Zor, occupied by ISIS, it's the Syrian army and allies on the ground that have been defending and keeping ISIS from moving further. So this attack on the soldiers in Deir ez-Zor was specifically not fighting ISIS, but the contrary, enabling ISIS to take over. And then, of course, you know, for those who've been following Syria, we know that on many occasions, the U.S. alliance has accidentally airdropped supplies to ISIS and terrorists in Syria. The Department of Defense website a couple of months ago listed that the coalition had done something like 15,000 sorties in the name of fighting ISIS. So why is ISIS still so prevalent if the U.S. coalition is fighting ISIS? The reality is it's not fighting ISIS, and the people who are the very ones who are being vilified.
Certainly, the State Department was very involved in that under Hillary Clinton. Trump, however, has been more reconcilable, it seems, with Russia. I'm not sure how reconcilable he is with Syria per se. But do you see some optimism in that area for the Syrian people?
I'm not really going to surmise too much about Trump. I mean, he's made comments and he's made promises. And I think the Syrian position has always been, we're willing to work with anybody who's willing to fight terrorism. So if that does mean that Trump adheres to his words, then the Syrian government would be willing, and I'm sure the Syrian people would be happy, because in the end, what they want is an end to the terrorism, the destruction of their country and the slaughter of their people, and a return to stability. So I would hope that, you know, Trump's words are true. And there is some hope in legislation that Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard recently introduced. It's not new legislation. It has to be said that the United Nations Security Council has passed resolutions already making it illegal and criminal to fund and arm these terrorists in Syria. But again, although these resolutions have been passed and not acted upon, it's good that Congresswoman Gabbard has taken the moral stance to reintroduce this type of legislation, Stop Arming Terrorist Bill. I would like to think that people would realize that it's not in the interest of the Syrian people or of America to be arming these terrorists.
So, Eva Bartlett, winding down this segment, you have been met with some resistance from across the spectrum, whether it's corporate media, international media, progressive press, and even up to the degree to which people have been trying to sort of sabotage some of your speaking tour.
Yeah, just before I get into that censorship, I will say that overwhelmingly, people who've come out for the talks have been pretty well informed, and they just want some sort of corroboration that what they've been reading and what they believe to be happening is what's happening. And they want to hear from voices on the ground. And I'll also say that what I've been presenting is largely what I've seen in Syria, the words of Syrians I've met with throughout the country, in Aleppo, in liberated Homs, in liberated Ma'loula, in areas where the media has maybe not reported on at all or has misreported on. That's all I've been doing. I'm not advocating for any particular government. I'm advocating what I'm standing against foreign intervention in Syria that is not welcomed by the Syrian government, and certainly against U.S. imperial interest in Syria and for the sovereignty of Syria. And so this seems to be a problem for people like Stephen Zunis. I didn't realize he was doing this, but prior to an event that was to take place in Santa Cruz, he systematically contacted by email, Facebook, and phone, and posting in public forums, organizers of the events to shut down two locations that had agreed to host me. He used rhetoric against me, implying that I'm supportive of genocide.
For those that don't know, Professor Stephen Zunis is at the University of San Francisco, a longtime advocate for nonviolence, etc.
He basically slandered me with a number of terms and accusations, and he was able to shut down two events that were going to host me that evening. The third event decided they would risk it and host me. And actually, because he was making such a fuss about me, people attended who might not have attended because they wanted to hear what I had to say.
Censorship has a way of backfiring.
Yeah. And I'll say that, to my knowledge, this is not the first time he's done this. I have a colleague who also visited Syria. And after she went to Syria, and she was part of the U.S. Peace Council coalition, he engaged in slander against her on Facebook and eventually blocked her.
Also Miriam Agnes.
Yes, Miriam Agnes, a nun who's...
Which Jeremy Scahill was also in on.
Yes, that's another shameful incident to do with the SS UKers. Jeremy Scahill and Owen Jones, I believe it was, threatened basically to walk out on a conference that Mother Agnes was invited to in the UK.
Conference.
Peace conference that she was invited to present her own observations living in Syria.
to merely sit on a panel and discuss it. And we interviewed her about it at the time. And for doing so, we were accused of being pro-Assad, pro-Putin, et cetera. Yeah. The same ad hominem kind of talk.
So my questions to Professor Zunis are, when were you last in Syria? Because he maintains he's been in Syria. Have you been in Syria since 2011? Because he seems to know everything about what's going on in Syria, according to his Human Rights Watch narrative. When were you last in Syria? You say these things about what's happening in Aleppo. Have you gone to Aleppo and spoken with the people? And my other question is, why do you not find the testimony, the witness on the ground testimony of Jan Oberg credible? He's in Aleppo. He was in eastern Aleppo. He was talking with the victims of these terrorists, and he was documenting. And yet Professor Zunis felt the need to jump on Jan Oberg's Facebook page and slur accusations at him. And Jan is on the ground. So, I mean, to me, this seems like very not academic censorship.
We certainly encourage dialogue. Perhaps one day we could even have Professor Zunis and you, Eva Bartlett, on a program to flesh out some of these perspectives and differences. Certainly at Project Censored, however, we don't encourage disparaging remarks. We don't encourage personal attacks. We just believe people have the right to say their piece and be heard and let the evidence come out and speak for itself and let people make up their own minds.
Absolutely.
Without being pressured into capitulation or to silence people a priori before you're even heard. So we certainly oppose censorship in all of its guises here. Eva Bartlett, is there a website you'd like to share with the listeners, a place that people can find your work more easily online?
As you mentioned, I think at the beginning, I have spent years doing solidarity work in Palestine. So my website is in Gaza. Gaza.wordpress.com. It will eventually morph into one after my own name, but for the moment, my writings from Syria, my videos from Syria, photos, you know, blog posts giving some insight into what Syrians were saying can be found on that website. I'd also like to point to the SyriaSolidarityMovement.org website, where you can find a number of excellent articles, resources as to what happened in early 2011, if people are still confused about that, intelligent analysis and updates. So I would recommend those two sites, and also the HandsOffSyriaCoalition.net, which is an important coalition in that it's actually gathered a number of groups, anti-war groups, anti-imperialist groups, to adhere to the basic principles of respecting Syria's sovereignty, not intervening in Syria if not, you know, invited, and ending the U.S. aggression on Syria. So I would recommend people look at that site as well, where they can find a number of articles and resources.
Eva Bartlett, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Next on the Project Censored Show, we'll be joined by Joey Johnson, and we'll be talking about flag burning and free expression, a little history up to the present in the United States. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On this segment of the program, we are going to be discussing the right to free expression, burning the flag in particular as political speech, stemming, of course, historically from a 1989 Supreme Court case, Texas v. Johnson, which upheld the right of Americans to burn the flag as protected speech and expression. We're joined by Joey Johnson, the Johnson of Texas v. Johnson, and his attorneys, William Kunstler, David Cole, were able to come out winning in this case, and not just a win for Johnson, but a case for free speech in general. But here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, to introduce Joey Johnson to you.
Joey Johnson was from Richmond, Indiana, and he's a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a longtime activist, and has burned flags a number of times, as well as been arrested for various anti-war activism and that. So William Kunstler was his attorney, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1989 that allows the burning of the flag as freedom of speech. And you're back at it again. You were arrested for burning the flag in Ohio. So, Joey, tell us about that experience and where you're headed.
I guess to start with Cleveland first, you're right. Myself, as part of the Revolution Club, which takes its leadership from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the revolutionary leader Bob Avakian, we went to Cleveland deliberately because you could see what was shaping up in terms of Trump's candidacy, and that what was being spewed out of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland was was fascism, as a open appeals to ugly, chauvinistic, xenophobic nationalism, ugly attacks on Muslims, ugly attacks on women, just horrific misogyny. And it needed to be opposed. It needed to be called out. And that's why we went there, to do that right in front of the convention center. And I had announced ahead of time that, and put out a press release, that I was going to burn the American flag, that I was in opposition to Trump's Make America Great Again, his America First, calls for America First, that I was going to burn the flag and take that internationalist stand with the people of the world, and that I was the person who had burned the flag and won the Supreme Court victory that made it protected political speech. So that's what we did. That's what we went there to do, and we did it defiantly in front of the convention center. And what I said before burning the flag, we chanted 1, 2, 3, 4, slavery, genocide, and war, 5, 6, 7, 8, America was never great. And I said, we're standing here with the people of the world. We're taking a stand against this imperialist Republican National Convention. Donald Trump is an open fascist. Hillary Clinton is a proven war criminal. We're not following either one of their leaders. America first. America has always been first at genocide, at slavery, at exploitation, at destruction of the environment, at torture. We're standing here with the people of the world, and then I lit the flag on fire, and I'm very proud of having done that. And it got out in the international media. It was part of the buzz that day, that in opposition to all this ugly chauvinism and America first, that's really toxic to the people of the world, I have to say. It's toxic. It's toxic, and horrific crimes can be committed in that mindset, and when that thinking is acted out. And so, yeah, we burned the flag in front of the convention center, and we were brutally arrested by the Cleveland police, the Homeland Security, Secret Service, and InfoWars operatives were involved in the attack on us, that your listeners should know.
Well, tell us a little bit more, Joey, about this, the InfoWars operatives. For those listeners that don't know, that would be Alex Jones, Kotiri.
Exactly. What happened was, when I was arrested and I'm in jail and I'm trying to learn what my charges are, we learned later that on the charging sheet they had initially written aggravated arson or disorderly conduct or failure to disperse, but all that was crossed out, and they put misdemeanor assault on two members of the media. And I was really puzzled while I was in jail. I said, what is that about? You know. And when I get out, I find out that there was a video posted by InfoWars operatives where they're bragging about having gone down there to assault me, to attack me, to prevent me from burning the flag. And they're bragging about having punched and kicked and torn at my T-shirt. So rather stupidly, I would say, they put all this on a video and uploaded it to YouTube the very same day. And you cannot be a victim of assault if you're bragging about having gone down to a rally site to assault someone. So we immediately turned over that video and as exculpatory evidence that our charges should be dismissed. Now, they've had that video since July, and yet the charges are still pending against us, and we have a court date coming up in January. We have to once again return to Cleveland, and we face trial. And these are very serious charges. There's 16 defendants in total, not only myself, but a total of 16 people. We call ourselves the RNC 16. And two people are facing serious felonies, facing more than 4 years in jail. So this is a political suppression, a political attack. We took a very good international stand, standing with the people of the world. There were thousands of flags being flown inside the convention center, as I say, part of this whole nauseous chauvinism of America first. And we opposed that, and we pierced it with the flag burning. And now they're attempting to exact revenge on us for what happened.
Well, Joey Johnson, since you brought up this issue, I wanted to go back for listeners to 1984. That's the convention. There was flag burning going on. You mentioned chants that you had going on here in Cleveland. Back then it was Reagan, Mondale, which will it be? Either one means World War III, that kind of thing. And there was, of course, flag burning going on in those events. And at some point you were charged with violating a Texas law that prohibited vandalizing it says, quote, respected objects or desecrating these objects. And you were actually convicted at one point, right?
I was convicted of what's called desecration of a venerated object. That was a Texas statute. And it's lifting the flag to the status of a religious icon, you know?
Theocratically. And,
exactly. And it, actually, I remember back then there was a whole thing where Salman Rushdie had written a novel called The Satanic Verses. And there was a fatwa put against him by the Ayatollah in Iran for committing blasphemy against Islam. And so some people started to make the connection. Oh, they're trying to get you for committing blasphemy against the flag, you know. And so that was part of the whole terrain that we were fighting this out on. And it took 5 years from the time I was convicted in Texas to the Supreme Court in D.C. And I had a whole year in jail sentence hanging up over my head during the course of that whole 5 years.
A couple $1,000 fine.
Yeah.
I mean, so in other words, you were just mentioning about how this is drawing out in Cleveland as a punitive process. Clearly what you went through here, 5 years.
Yeah. And one thing I really want to bring to the attention of your listeners is that this has gone to a whole another level and gotten much more magnified in terms of its importance off of Trump's victory in the election and his tweet threat, where he tweeted out on November 29th, Trump tweeted out that nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail.
You know, and, you know, Hillary Clinton also supported the flag-burning amendment back in the day. So both of the major candidates kind of have a similar stance that this is some kind of blasphemy.
Absolutely, they have a similar stance. Hillary Clinton in 2005 promoted a new federal statute that would have made it a year in jail and a $100,000 fine if you burned a flag. And actually, a $250,000 fine if it was a government flag, you know, if it was taken from a government building or what have you. So, you know, they're both on the same page when it comes to needing to galvanize people around the flag. And as Malcolm X used to say, hate who you're told to hate and follow that flag into war, you know, invade who you're told to invade. They need this imperialist symbol. It's not optional to them.
So, Joy Johnson, after your Supreme Court win, the United States Congress enacted legislation outlawing the desecration of the flag. So they passed a law saying that you can't do that. President George H.W. Bush, he didn't sign that law, but he allowed it to go into effect. Now, the Flag Protection Act went into effect on October 28, 1989, and then 2 days later, you're out burning a flag again with many others in front of the Capitol building. What was the results of that?
The result of that was a second Supreme Court case in which, once again, our right to burn the flag was upheld. You know, one thing I think is important to point out for your listeners, again, is that our victories in the Supreme Court, these were not a gift from America. You know, this was hard fought for. And it's important because, you know, the Supreme Court is a highly political body, and it's like a barometer of what the issues that are on the table in front of the ruling class and how they see dealing with them and what are going to be the consequences of the reverberations. And they'll take the exact same questions of law and rule one way at one point in history and another way at another point in history, whether you're going back to the Dred Scott decision having to do with Black people having no rights that a white person is bound to respect, or abortion or immigration or any number of issues, right? And to contextualize the ruling in my own case, what was going on in the world at the time was that another imperialist empire out there, the Soviet Union, was imploding, you know, and the countries in Eastern Europe were, and we're talking about 1989, 1990. And in 1989, I remember distinctly that in Romania, some dissidents had cut out the hammer and sickle out of the Romanian flag. And I don't think that Romania had anything to do with any, like, real vibrant, real socialism. So I understand their alienation and all that. But I think it more kind of created a dilemma for the government in this country where how are they going to applaud these dissidents in Eastern Europe at the same time jailing one right here at home? So you see, you understand what I'm saying? This is really important for people to understand. And not only that, but not only did we fight in the courtroom, but we fought out in society. And William Kunstler, my attorney at the time, and myself traveled and spoke at law schools. We spoke at high schools. We spoke in the media so that people would understand. This was about compulsory patriotism.
Yeah, I remember this. I was a senior in high school. And actually, I was a freshman in college, and I wrote a song about the case, and the curious last line of it was, why is it so much more important to have a symbol than the thing that it stands for?
You know, all of us grew up with that mandated pledge to the flag in school every day, and certainly the flag's meaning has broad understandings of what that is. But in reality, what we really have here is a piece of cloth that's red, white, and blue and has symbols on it, but it's still a piece of cloth. And if in your mind that piece of cloth represents U.S. imperialism, war, and, you know,
slavery, genocide,
you know,
occupation,
all the above, yes,
the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
yes,
torture,
then you have every
Native
right
Americans.
Under our laws to symbolically burn that. And how we can say that we have free speech in America and in some way want to protect this piece of cloth, and matter whose interpretation it is ludicrous. And certainly the Supreme Court found it that way. So what's going to happen with your case now?
Well, at this point, the court in Cleveland is going forward with the charges. And it's very important that
is this the charge of attacking journalists or burning the flag?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's retaliation for the flag burning. But once again, they were in a dilemma about how are they going to criminally prosecute me.
Well, it's throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall, I mean, is what it sounds like.
Exactly.
What and sticks.
Yeah, it's outrageous, and people got to be part of demanding that the charges be dropped. And I hope people will contact us at freernc16@gmail.com, or they can telephone us at 510-253-5551. And this flag case is not happening in a vacuum. There's a whole ascendancy of this fascist regime of Trump and company. And it really is fascist. He's putting together a team now that's a bunch of fascist ghouls. I mean, Pence, Bannon, Flynn, Sessions, Pompeo. This is a nightmare in terms of the implications if we let this regime consolidate power. And I'm part of this whole refusefascism.org movement and calling on people to get in the streets and their millions and tens of millions before this regime is allowed to consolidate power. And there's upcoming protests that are going on Martin Luther King Day in January. And then we need to all be in D.C., and I'm talking about millions, tens of millions of people, to block this inauguration from being able to happen to begin with. And these are the stakes for humanity. Don't let them consolidate power. There's this imposition of fascism that's way beyond the attempt to muzzle people with the flag around the flag-burning case.
You know, some activists take the American flag and say, this is my flag, and I'm opposed to imperialism, and I believe in the Bill of Rights and the International Declaration of Human Rights, and that this is what this represents to me. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think people can attempt to do that. You know, it's a fabric of oppression. You know, symbols, you can say, well, I'm going to attach a new meaning. But this is the flag that was carried by the 7th Cavalry when they massacred the Native Americans at Wounded Knee. This is the flag that flies on every bomb that's dropped or every armed predator drone that flies over Afghanistan and Iraq and Somalia and a whole arc of countries across the Middle East. And this is the flag of empire. It's the brand symbol for U.S. imperialism. And so people have to come to terms with that. And if you want to stand with the people of the world, listen, patriotism is long outdated. It does great harm. We live in a world that's so interconnected now, but patriotism means love of country. So right there, you're putting your country ahead of other countries and other peoples around the world. And I think people should break out of that. And I'm about building a movement for an actual revolution to get humanity beyond capitalism and imperialism and flags being symbols of national markets. But that's a whole other discussion. In the meantime, people shouldn't let this political repression go down.
Indeed, the late historian Howard Zinn once said, there is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people. We're in conversation this segment of the show with Joey Johnson. He is the Johnson from Texas v. Johnson in 1989, the Supreme Court decision that upheld the right to burn the flag as political expression, as free speech and expression. It was a 5-4 case. There was a very interesting series of writings on both sides. And the curious thing, the William Rehnquist dissent is reminiscent of many of the things that we've been hearing this past fall, the idea that, of course, people have the right to express their opinions, but it's the way in which they're expressing it that is loathsome or, quote, inappropriate. We've heard this, Joey Johnson, and I wanted to get your view on this. This issue came front and center into the living rooms of America through the secular yet somehow strangely religious phenomenon of football in the National Football League with the San Francisco 49er quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He decided that as an African-American, he would take a knee during the singing of the national anthem as a means of solidarity with Black Lives Matter, with pointing out that there are many things that the United States does that the flag represents that he believes go against what the actual values of America might be ensconced in the Bill of Rights or Constitution, the rhetoric versus the reality. And he certainly got it with both barrels. I mean, he was tarred and feathered and just dragged all through the news as being unpatriotic. I mean, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg at one point on the Supreme Court made a very disparaging remark toward him and later retracted it. But nevertheless, this is right in line in many ways with what you're dealing with now in your case.
Right. You know, I think it's beautiful what Colin has done, what Colin Kaepernick has done, because he has given voice and he's opened up this argument and this discussion across society. And in his words were, why should I stand for the flag when there are so many bodies in the street, dead bodies, black bodies, and other people of color, and people are on paid leave, you know, referring to the police that murder with impunity in this country every day across the country. And so it's extremely important what he's done in terms of challenging people. Yeah, but look at the way he's been retaliated against. Some of these football games have been almost like lynch mobs, you know, lynch mob rallies where they've had flags the size of the entire field. And mm-hmm. it's straight up to try to intimidate and to try to break him and to get him to buckle under. And I'm glad, I'm very proud of the fact that he has not. So definitely I see him as a kindred spirit in all of this.
There's a knee-jerk, groupthink, conformist shaming that collectively happens and is aimed at people like Kaepernick, like yourself, like going back under the W. Bush years with the Dixie Chicks. Remember the
Absolutely.
Just shut up and sing. And with Kaepernick, it's shut up and play. And of course, with people that are, you know, real in the streets, political activists like yourself, it's that you don't even deserve a place at the table in the American political system to even voice that dissent in the corporate media or within political parties, right? Not invited to the debates, pushed out to the sides. I mean, again, that goes against the entire notion. We've been talking about the cloth of the flag. The flag is a piece of fabric, right? But what about the fabric of a truly democratic culture or society, which by action, the United States does not seem to be?
Right. You know, it's interesting what you're saying, because after Trump did his tweet threat, you know, that flag burners should be jailed for a year or be stripped of their citizenship, and that was like 6:55 a.m. in the morning that he did this, and I'm still asleep, and I get a call from the East Coast where they're 3 hours ahead of us, and people were telling us, look, did you hear about this? I'm like, wow, this is heavy. And so immediately I worked on trying to respond to it in the media, and there were a few reporters that wanted to actually talk to me. You know, there were a few reporters. I would say that they were kind of quirky, nonconformist people that still managed to keep their jobs at a mainstream newspaper. But overall, including the editorial and opinion pages of the newspapers, they did not want to hear from me. You know, in other words, they wanted to keep it up in the upper stratosphere, you know, what they thought, why they were opposed to what Trump was doing from their own perspective. They didn't want to let the riffraff or the revolutionaries into the conversation. That's what I'll say about that. But I really want to say, too, to your listeners, go to refusefascism.org and be part of taking on this fight overall in society. The fascist moves around the flag are not separate from the fascistization of society overall. You can't have a society that's based on this xenophobic nationalism, this ultra-nationalism, hyper-nationalism, and not have a flag for that system, for that ideology, for that empire.
As an assault of people of color, as an assault on people of foreign nations, there's assaults on the climate, on the planet.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a very broad-based, philosophical construct here that you're pointing out. Peter?
I participated in two ceremonial flag burnings in my life. One was in the early 60s as a Boy Scout, and we had an old tattered flag that we ceremonially burned, which is supposedly the way of disposing of a flag. And the other was in 1970 at Santa Clara University. As a senior, we burnt a flag during the military parades that were ongoing as opposed to the war. And I was a member of the SDS chapter and graduating senior, so they just let us graduate. And those that weren't seniors were all expelled. So there's some history there. I recognize that some people really consider the flag with meaning. However, certainly your context of how the flag is transnational now in terms of military empire in the world and really represents the police force for the transnational capitalist class, I think we're way beyond patriotism in that sense. And so I certainly have to say that I agree with you very much, Joey.
I'll have to come and chime in now and say, after your 1989 and 1990 cases, I mentioned a song that I'd done before about this. I also participated in a ceremonial burning of the flag at an event specifically for this issue as an on-purpose way of suggesting that this is about discussion, this is about dialogue. Of course, not everyone agrees with it. But the point was that to criminalize that significant form of expression is utterly fascistic.
That's the dilemma I think that the Trump regime is facing now, because Trump's tweet was actually in response to a flag burning that had happened in Hampshire College, in a small liberal arts college in Massachusetts. And the students there were outraged. And it actually happened around a number of colleges and universities around the country, a number of cities. People burned flags after Trump's election victory. So if they make patriotism compulsory, attach one permissible meaning, pro-state, pro-government, pro-empire, pro-imperialism.
Pro-personality, pro-Trump.
Exactly.
When it's embodied in a person.
If they make it, if that's forced patriotism, if they do that, then it can backfire on them.
Well, Joey Johnson, we're about ready to wrap up this segment. Any parting words for our audience?
I just want to emphasize that we should not wait until the Trump regime has consolidated power, and they're doing the roundups of our immigrant brothers and sisters. They're doing the registration of our Muslim brothers and sisters. We shouldn't be reactive to all that. We should stop this regime before it starts, and that's the call for millions and tens of millions of people to be in the streets with refusefascism.org and to get involved and to take this up. The statement, the plan is all there on that website. Go there and get involved.
Well, there are certainly many ways people can get involved, and at Project Censored, we certainly encourage free, open dialogue, no censorship, and we certainly support people's civic participation how they see necessary, and including Joey Johnson, your acts and your courageous acts of the last several decades in this regard. So thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
So that does it for today's episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to Anthony Fest. Also special thanks to our guest producer and engineer, Erica Bridgman. We are now on 37 stations around the United States. For more information about Project Censored, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
By a criminal. democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.